Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Six love, 6-1 is the scoreline we've just had in the afternoon session on day three here at the ATP World Tour Finals. And who's been on the end of that? Kei Nishikori. Who's won it? Kevin Anderson. My goodness, what on earth is going on? It means we've all stopped play about 4 hours ahead of schedule, and it gives us a chance to record the first part of the Tennis Podcast here in the company of Mr. Simon Briggs. Hello, Simon.
Hiya.
We've got Grad Matt.
Hello.
And by special demand, back here on the Tennis Podcast, we've only got Catherine Whittaker. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, special demand from the Whittaker family.
Yeah. And everybody else, they've been flooding in.
Not special demand from the Whittaker family, because all they've been doing is texting me about how good the various Telegraph reps are and how good Grad Matt is.
Yeah. How's your week
been? So no special demand whatsoever.
Have you had a lovely time?
It's been lovely, yeah. Quite like watching tennis on the telly.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah. Tennis is good. What has happened this afternoon? I don't understand. Simon Briggs, you watched it.
Yeah, I didn't pay that much attention to the first set because I was doing my latest update on Benito versus Federer, the rematch, of which more later. But I did start to plug in when I realised that there was a potential double bagel approaching, and Nishikori saved himself from that fate in the last possible moment. He was 6-love, 5-love down, and he dug out actually a shot rather similar to the one he dug out against Roger in his first match, a sort of desperate backhand slice that went for a winner. And by that token, he avoided the first double bagel here since 2005. Not here, I should say, but at the ATP Finals, which apparently was Federer versus Gaston Gaudio.
Oh, yes, I do remember that.
David and I watched some of this fleeting match over a late lunch. And at 6-love, 4-love, I put you on the spot and said, does Kevin Anderson have it in him to inflict a double bagel? And you said, yeah.
I underestimated him. Overestimated him.
I mean, I don't know whether any sort of inbuilt microchip of Kevin Anderson's that tells him he can't inflict a double bagel on someone had anything to do with what happened today.
Yes.
But he didn't do it. I don't know. I just wonder if there's like something buried deep in his subconscious that says, oh, there's no need to... You can win, Kev, but...
They need to humiliate the poor
fella. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, exactly.
Matt, the other day, I think the common consensus was that Kei Nishikori won but wasn't great. Was he really awful today, or was Kevin Anderson just amazing?
He was really awful. he was really bad. He made so many errors. His first serve percentage was really low. Anderson did play well, and that's reflected in the score. If Anderson had been bad, it might have been a bit more like what we saw with Nishikori and Federer the other night, but Anderson just took care of him. And in that sense, it played true to Sunday's form when Anderson was good and Nishikori was bad, and it was more of the same, just slightly exaggerated today. And I did sort of get the feeling, kind of, when you get 6-love, 5-love, it's kind of like when you're extra time in a football match and you've gone all that way, you kind of want it to go to penalties. You kind of wanted to see the double bagel, but...
You wanted the double bagel. That's the kind of man we've
Matt's got the microchip,
into.
Yeah.
I kind of did, but yeah, he got that consolation game. There's a bit of pity applause, and they tried to do the decibel meter to try and get the crowd up.
Worse than they did the decibel meter
as soon as it went to 6-love, 5-1, as though this was going to mount some sort of comeback. But no, it was over, and it was a blowout. And
he hasn't qualified yet, though, has he, Kevin Anderson?
He virtually has, but mathematically no. If Team wins tonight, he'll be through and Federer will be out. And if Federer wins in three, Anderson will be through.
Okay, well, that's still to come, and we'll be reviewing that later.
It's the first ironic use of the decibel meter.
Yes.
They don't actually have third sets at this tournament. It's a little bit like the next gen. You know? That's only a two-set tournament.
Five straight sets matches, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and it's been a trend, not just this year, hasn't it? In fact, today was more... They've been respectable score lines up till this one, but today was more in the pattern of the last couple of years when it's been really, like, one-sided.
And to be very reductive about it, what do you chalk that up to? Do you think there's any element of the mental fatigue of this stage of the season, players just not able to to muster what it requires to fight back into a match, to hang tough in a match?
I've always put it down to that, but the only other point somebody raised with me recently was that it could be a factor of a round robin. So if you're on your way out of a knockout tournament, then maybe you have a little bit of extra fire in your gut.
Less jeopardy.
You know that you're not going to get any more money and you'll have to buy that plane ticket, whereas here, as Matt accurately points out, the permutations are complex and endless, which sort of muddies the waters a little bit.
Yeah, I must say, Nishikori being on the end of this defeat is a bit bizarre, because he was actually in quite good form coming into this tournament. Often we do have a lot of players who come in here sort of crawling over the finish line to the season, but actually Nishikori, since the US Open, has put together a lot of good results. He was on a bit of a hot streak. Maybe he's just completely burnt out, but I kind of thought he would play okay here, but he's playing about, I don't know, C, D level of his actual game.
Maybe Roger dragged him down with that yeah. dreadful effort on Sunday. I mean,
we do sometimes see results and matches that I think we probably wouldn't see elsewhere in the year. The fatigue does play a part, doesn't it?
Oh, without, how could it not? It's the final, but barring team events, discussion thereof forthcoming, it's the final event of the year. Fatigue is cumulative. How could it not? You know, it's more of a factor at the US Open than it is at the Australian Open. But I mean, just as yesterday you all discussed the sort of reverting to type is potentially too harsh, but you know, Marin Cilic's trend of choking. Nishikori has his own personal trend of completely and utterly failing to back up spectacular wins, doesn't he? That's his thing, disappointing in the subsequent match after a big victory. That is sort of his... I mean, he has other things as well, but that is one of his hallmarks.
This one certainly did come out of the blue, though, in terms of the lopsidedness of it. It is bizarre. Anyway, there's enough of that. Let's talk about this real head-to-head that you've been talking about.
Yeah.
Stuff that you covered last night, Simon, of Julian Beneteau doing an interview in which he was highly critical of Roger Federer, or at least the way in which, in his version of events, tennis kind of... incidentally, we have the BBC group next to us celebrating Sue Barker's Ron Bookman Award win, and the champagne is flowing. So,
Do you think you should explain what the Ron Bookman Award is? It is not, you know, the most familiar
it's for media
presentation
excellence.
To the sporting public.
Media excellence, isn't it?
It's not a BAFTA. I mean, you know... Sue is deserving of a BAFTA.
It's way better
BAFTA
than a BAFTA.
Listening.
Anyway, they're delighted because they've got the champagne flowing. And yes, media excellence, Sue Barker. So, Simon, what's gone on? Julian Beneteau has been on a radio show and he's not too impressed with the way that, I suppose, the red carpet is rolled out for Roger Federer wherever he goes and things are skewed in his favour. Is that fair enough?
It was rather like Beneteau went into the studio and didn't actually think they'd turn the microphone on. It was reminiscent of those political briefings we had early in the Brexit process where it sounded like the Conservatives weren't aware that people in the EU could read. You know, it was that kind of thing. And like, either he was trying to get a bit of profile now that he's retired. I think he has retired, hasn't he? I mean, he has retired.
There have been
comings and goings in Beneteau's retirement schedule.
He has had cake in his honour.
Right.
That is the signal of official retirement.
So either he was looking for profile.
He's had a few cakes.
Yeah. Or he just thought, you know, I'm on What was it, RMC?
Radio Monte Carlo, okay. But which is a national radio station. It's
and he didn't think that anyone was really going to notice, so he started telling the truth, which is always a dangerous game. Anyway, the subject matter he addressed was that he felt Roger Federer was too politically involved in the backstage manoeuvrings of tennis, which, as we know, are complex and sometimes murky. And that it was interfering with maybe his involvement in tournaments, but also in his stances on things like the New Davis Cup. And also, Benito said that, you know, his agent, Tony Godzik, had been going into the referee's office at the US Open and saying he will not play on the new Louis Armstrong court, he will be on Arthur Ashe. To which the US Open quickly responded. They were the only party that did respond to us last night. They said, well, we didn't have to have that conversation because, as far as we were concerned, Serena, Roger and Rafa were all going to be on our Ash every match in any case. We've since had today Craig Tiley response to Beneteau's comments, because Beneteau said that Tiley was receiving money from teammate Federer's management company via the Labour Cup in which they're partners, and was then conflicted when he put Roger on at the prime time slot, 12 out of 14 matches at the Australian Open in the last 2 years.
I think it was 13 out of 14. Anyway,
I mean, the response then came in, Craig Tiley, and as Ben Rothenberg neatly put it on Twitter, the sort of substance of that response was almost like, yeah, and?
So we
obviously be putting Roger on the prime time slot. I mean, who wouldn't?
It was a really lengthy, wordy sort of shrug of the shoulders.
Just to give you a couple of tidbits from what he said. In terms of players and their appeal, it needs to be said that Roger Federer is a once-in-a-generation player, widely regarded as one of the biggest box office athletes in the world. He's been regularly voted Australia's favourite athlete. The fans demand his appearance in the big stadiums, and our broadcasters naturally want his matches to air in prime time. And I don't think that there's a tournament director in the world who's not going to take those factors into account when setting the schedule. This is the case with all the big names in tennis and sport in general. He also describes the Laver Cup as a disruptor in men's tennis.
Also, this has been viewed as that because it's been successful. He hasn't put it quite as cleanly as that, but that's the meaning he's trying to express. Basically, it's sour grapes from the rest of the tennis world. Laver Cup has been a runaway success, as far as he's concerned, and everyone else is jealous. That was what I read into it. And the whole background of the story to me is it's a very interesting grey area, because basically what it's about is how much is tennis a pure sport and how much is it an entertainment? And we've been over this quite a lot when I've been on the tennis podcast. And I think as a reporter in a dwindling band of full-time reporters, I tend towards the view that you can't expect tennis to be whiter than white. If you were going to have a totally pure sport, you would take every name in the draw, put it in a big hat, and it would spit out who's on what court at random. And you know, you're not necessarily going to want to have Krajinovic against Djuma on centre and Roger on court 12.
But then the logical conclusion of that, the other end of the spectrum, is that we all just prostrate ourselves at the feet of market forces.
Which is why it's difficult. And market forces,
is what Wimbledon used to justify their gender bias scheduling, and what is used to justify an awful lot of things that various different powers within tennis could rise above and could work to correct if they wanted to. And some are in more of a privileged position financially and power-wise to do so than others. But I'm playing devil's advocate a little, because I don't disagree with you, but you inevitably have to land in a grey area, which is sort of uncomfortable.
It's sport and it's entertainment.
I actually think Wimbledon got it right this year, in that they did, surprisingly at the time, put Federer out on court one, for instance, for a match. A match he ended up losing. Now, whilst that may be awful for the Federer fans, and yes, maybe the bottom line as well, and viewing figures, etc., it added some credibility to me to the tournament, in that it just made it a bit more of a level playing field.
But I don't disagree with you. However, this argument that Craig Tiley is making, and it echoes many others that we've heard over the years, singularly fails to acknowledge the role that the likes of Tennis Australia and the other governing bodies have in creating the market in which they themselves are operating. I think, again, the waters are muddied by the fact that we're talking about Roger Federer, who is so exceptional and so transcendent within the sport. It kind of makes it difficult. But, you know, you persistently put these people... You're creating stars by persistently putting them on the biggest stage, by bringing them to the attention. You know, again, for me, the most sort of stark example of it is with, you know, along gender lines. You know, women, you say, oh, you know, women aren't as big as stars as the big four in the men's game. Well, if you keep putting them on the third biggest stadium and don't give them the opportunity to take the stage, then they're going to be. You're creating those market forces. So I'm not advocating that we ignore market forces altogether. I'm absolutely not. I'm not naive enough to do that. I just think statements like there is such a failure to acknowledge and take responsibility for the fact that we all, to greater and lesser degrees, and the likes of Tennis Australia, with their power as a governing body in the tennis world to a greater degree, do have more power to set the rules of the game than they acknowledge.
Mm. Novak Djokovic came out in support of his rival last night, Roger Federer, didn't he? He said, look, he's the biggest star. It's normal, basically, that he would get that sort of scheduling.
Yeah, this is a difficult tournament to cover sometimes because you get press conferences happening at sort of 10:30 and then you've got to make your way out and sort of find your way home and drag yourself in the morning. And I woke up thinking that Novak had said... Roger Federer, in my opinion, is men's tennis. Which he hadn't. John Isner said that about 10 minutes earlier because they were both asked.
Yes, that's right.
And I was thinking, wow, that's a good subject. Maybe that's a column. Then I discovered that I'd invented the whole thing.
How far did you get with the column?
Yeah, not very far. I mean, nevertheless, Novak did, you know, not twitch or grimace or show any hesitation in really backing the Federer side, which was in itself interesting, not as interesting as it would have been if he had said Roger Federer is men's tennis.
To go off on a slight tangent, it's a good indicator of where Novak Djokovic is psychologically, though, isn't it? He's obviously so supremely comfortable, not feeling any chips on his shoulder whatsoever. I think a slightly more insecure Djokovic about his place in the world and maybe his potential to, dare I say, overtake Nadal and Federer might not be quite so forthcoming with a comment like that. Whether he felt it deep down or not, he might be less likely to say it.
I thought the way he didn't even hesitate was a good example of the fact that he's not feeling very aggrieved at the moment. I actually spoke to Marion Vida at the ATP Finals launch in John Bercow's apartments on Friday.
These are the sort of circles in which Simon Briggs...
When you say his apartments plural,
that probably shouldn't have had a plural. His rooms, his rooms at the House of Commons.
How many though. Does he have?
Well, he's definitely got a few rooms. Yeah, I mean, we were being sort of hustled in and out of them at various times while presentations were being made to the Coach of the Year and so on. Which was, in fact, Marion Vida, and Andrew Castle was doing a manful job in a front room. You know, very grand front room with wonderful ceiling and portraits on the walls and mullioned windows and so on, but quite a difficult front room in which to, you know, they had to put a little bit of a dais up there, and it was a little tricky for the presentation. But it's certainly a fascinating venue and the latest in the series of ATP launch venues. They've been around all the landmarks of London, Tower of London, Cutty Sark and Battersea Power Station over the years it's been here. Anyway, that was the venue. The conversation was about Novak, and he was just saying to me he just is so much more balanced than he's ever seen him.
Really?
Marion was saying that, you know, he more than when he was dominating in 11 or 15, he just seems to be unstressed and at one with himself, which is pretty terrifying, really, isn't it, if you're not Novak Djokovic and you're a professional tennis player.
Well, particularly given his performance last night, which was just sublime.
But really, over the last... I mean, he wasn't troubled in Shanghai, was he? He wasn't troubled at the US Open. You know, it feels like a revert to norm. And before I was in here talking to Naomi Cavaday, she was saying, you know, she wants to know, does anyone have a strategy against him? Like, does anyone actually go out thinking, I'm going to get into this bit of his game?
Or, do people just go out there? Like Gilles Simon did at the Australian Open that year, and he just slowballed him and junked him the whole time.
I think John Isner thought that he would be able to keep him at bay with his big game, and it just
quite early on he
bounced off.
He was sort of shrugging and holding his hands up.
I think he broke his heart in the first few games.
The first serve came back, didn't it? It was a 130 mile an hour serve. Wide to the forehand, came back right at his toes, wide, nailed the spot he was looking for, but
and Isner subsequently described him as the first, second and third best returner in the sport of all time.
Yeah, oh dear, good luck everybody. just going back to Beneteau, his comments and Laver Cup, do you have concerns with that? I mean, there's loads of sort of conflicts of interest within this sport. They're all over the place. Just the nature of the way things are. Do you have major concerns for the way the sport is based on all those conflicts, Simon?
Well, yeah, but I don't think that the one that Beneteau was highlighting is like very high up the list. it's an interesting area, and I don't necessarily dispute what you're saying, but I think we all know that Roger gets. I mean, it's a bit like the statement. Yeah, and I mean that is it. Roger gets preferential treatment. Roger, as Novak and John Isner says, has earned preferential treatment. The question about the sports administration is much more highlighted in the total schmozzle over the Davis Cup. The fact the ITF have sold it to Cosmos. The fact that the team tennis tournaments are now basically going to be running in conflict with each other for the next couple of years, unless something is resolved very late in the day.
Zverev is telling everyone that no one apart from Rafa is even going to consider playing.
Yeah, and then the fact that the players are still struggling to arrive at the end of the season with their bodies intact, and it's just going to make it that much worse. So, you know, interesting points by Beneteau. I can see why he says them. I have sympathy for his position, but I don't think they are too high up the agenda.
Be interesting to see if he comes out at all again, either to backtrack, as sometimes you see.
But he has been on Twitter.
Has he? What's he saying?
To clarify things, I'm just saying that we must avoid conflicts of interest as much as possible in order to preserve some sporting fairness. There is nothing personal about Roger Federer, because I'm the first to say that it is the greatest. I think is there anybody that would dispute that this sport has too many conflicts of interest?
That's the other point, isn't it, which I haven't made, is you know, I mean, you look around the ATP board or anybody's players box, and it's just there's so many people working with so many hats on, it's just quite terrifying. And the Labour Cup does embody, you know, quite an extreme example of that, probably with teammates.
His word disruptor bothers me, because I think he's absolutely right.
But he sounds like he's really taking a pride in that.
Well, yeah, and that bothers me.
Yeah.
Because I have a huge amount of respect for Craig Tiley as a person, as an operator, but I do think he's created a great event. I just think we need to create an amazing Davis Cup, personally, and I'd rather see all the efforts and attention and energy put into that, frankly. And I think, unfortunately, this gets in the way. As good fun as it is.
But then the problem is with the governing setup, in which the ITF had been they've been floundering with the Davis Cup for so long that it was definitely much easier to start an exciting new event than it was to reinvent the Davis Cup in an exciting way. From that point of view, you know, Tennis Australia is a very interesting case study. You know, 35 years ago, the Australian Open was an afterthought. Now it's arguably the best tournament in the world. I mean, it's certainly the biggest tournament in the world, and the number of the people you get in there. I was speaking to the coach at my tennis club the other day, and he was just absolutely banging on about how much he loved it, why it's so special, such an incredible feel there. They are risk takers. They have shown a willingness to bend the envelope. And it's true that that's causing problems now, but it's only causing problems because the sport has a sick setup. If the sport was healthy, then that would be beneficial.
I don't disagree with you, but at some point someone's got to take responsibility and say, and not just sort of surrender at the sick setup of tennis and say, oh, well, you know, we're all at its mercy, we might as well just play this dodgy game. Surely someone out there has got to go, hang on a second, I care about tennis in the long term more than I care about any of this other hoo-ha. No one's doing that.
I mean, Tennis Australia's set up, or their thinking on this, is that they have to invest in big events because that's where it's all going, and that's why they also were very behind the World Team Cup. You know, they wanted to get ahead of the curve. They know that a 250 event is largely loss-making, and the 500 may struggle, and that the bigger the event, that's where the money is. They want to defend their position. They are looking to get out ahead of the curve, thinking that tennis will continue to stratify in this way, with the stronger getting stronger and the weak getting weaker. And you can understand that as a business proposition, why that would make sense.
Let's hope they all work it out.
Let's hope chances
they all get around this table, get some of Sue Barker's champagne, get that down.
That's the table they need to be around,
and
right
come
there.
And have a
That's
good
a
old
fun
chat
old table
and work it all out between them. Right. Well, we've got an evening session of matches to look forward to. Catherine, lovely having you back on the Tennis Podcast.
Are we not going to make ourselves look silly by talking about what might happen
on,
in the
give
evening
us a quick
session?
Prediction, then let's have it.
I think Federer is going to win.
Right, okay. Sam Briggs?
I think Team's going to win.
Oh, blimey. I'm going to go for Federer going to win. What do you say, Matt?
Yeah, I said Federer yesterday, so I've got to stick with that.
These are going to be the last words uttered on this segment of the podcast before you come back with the actual result.
Yeah,
brilliant.
See you in 2 seconds.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Well, Roger Federer won pretty easily. 6-2, 6-3, and a second set in which I think, Matt, he only lost 1 point on serve.
Mm.
What was the story of the match? Was this Roger Federer just gloriously reminding us that we're all talking utter nonsense, or was this Dominic Thiem playing atrociously?
Mainly the latter, I would say. Thiem's had a history of not brilliant matches on hard courts, and this was probably one of the worst, to be honest. 34 unforced errors, I think he racked up in those two fairly quick sets.
Yeah.
Federer was certainly better than he was the other night. He was less irritated by the whole thing.
Yeah.
A lot
less
calmer.
Ratty.
Less ratty.
Ratty,
yeah.
Roger.
Yeah.
Had been put back in his cage.
Yeah. And he was pretty calm, untroubled, went up a break and then a double break in the first set, and it was better. His backhand noticeably was a lot better. I thought he exchanged backhands pretty well with team, and it was yet another match at these ATP finals that wasn't particularly competitive.
Yeah, and six straight sets matches in the singles so far. And I think the thing that struck me, and he alluded to it in his first answer in the press conference, was it was about mindset tonight. It wasn't about forehands and backhands. For whatever reason, he was in a bad mood the other day. A couple of things went wrong, and then suddenly his whole mindset was negative. And he said that afterwards, first thing he was asked was, why did you cancel a practice session at Queen's Club? And he said, it's true, I did do that, and I'm going to do it again tomorrow, because the problem wasn't in my forehands and backhands. It wasn't about that. The shots are there. He said the problem was in my head. And he said on the long journey back after the Nishikori match, we had a good chat about it, and they said, you know, you need to just take a day off and get in a good headspace, didn't they? They said, you need to come out optimistic.
Mm.
And that's how he looked.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's planning to do the same tomorrow, to not practice again, he said, because it works so well. And actually, he explained the Nishikori defeat a lot better in press today than I thought he did the other night. On Sunday evening, he said he just hadn't been practicing that well, and it was about adjusting to the conditions, which, yes, is a factor, but everyone has to adjust to the conditions.
I think even he, after 18 years of doing this, was still was a little confused as to why he'd played like that at that time. And I think having been able to give it some thought, had some better news tonight, he understands it more. And it leaves us not knowing a clear picture about who's going to qualify from this group. But I tell you, I usually turn to you whenever we've got these issues. I'm going to turn to you now. I mean, you've got a sheet of paper here with the various permutations on it. I'm not even going to begin to try to sum them up for you. Just go and find them. They'll be on social media somewhere. But I mean, my head hurts just looking at it. Who's going
to... Yeah, I think a good way to sum up how confusing it is that Federer can lose and go through, and he can win and go out. So it really is...
I don't remember one quite like this here, you know, I don't think.
I seem to remember there was one in the very first year where it was confusing with Del Potro, Federer and Murray.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
But
they've done a much better job at rolling this out very quickly.
Very
indeed.
Quickly,
there are a few criteria there that basically say, it might go down to game percentage, so we will have to wait and see.
Anderson is in a very strong position. He is pretty much qualified on every scenario. There's only one where he loses in two and Nishikori wins in two where it would go down to games, but with him having thrashed Nishikori today, game percentage is very much in his favour.
Right. Oh, well, see, now we do know, because Matt's laid that out very clearly, so thank you for that, Matt. Now, that's the tennis that we've seen today. We've obviously been talking in the rest of the show about this situation with comments from Julian Beneteau about Roger Federer and his influence in the game, and suggesting he gets preferential treatment through various issues and conflicts of interest within the game. That situation, those comments, were put to Roger Federer in his press conference after the match. This is what happened.
Roger, are you aware of the comments made by Julian Beneteau in a French radio interview about sort of suggesting you getting favourable scheduling? I wonder if you got any reaction to that.
I don't.
You don't know about the comments, or you don't?
I know about the comments, yeah, but I don't really feel the mood during a World Tour Finals to discuss that topic, to be honest. And in all fairness, I hope you understand why, because this is a bit of a celebration of tennis here. For me, it's the year-end finale, and I love playing here. And the radio interview that happened over a week ago that surfaces now in French, Julien, who's a nice guy, I know him since the junior times, and I think all of this has totally been taken out of context. I don't feel like I need to comment on this, and rather put it to rest rather than adding to it, so you guys got something to write about. Thank you, guys.
Just one question on that note. Is it correct, though, the claim that your agent requested that you not play in Armstrong this year and would your agent normally makes scheduling requests like that?
I get asked, would you play, like to play Monday or Tuesday sometimes? Sometimes I get asked, do you want to play day or night? Sometimes they go ask the agent. Sometimes they ask me, you know, Asia wants you to play at night. So, yes, sometimes we have our say, but I asked to play Monday at the US Open. I play Tuesday night. It's all good, you know. I've had that problem for 20 years in the good way. Sometimes I get help, sometimes I don't. And I think there you have it. Yeah, and sometimes they come ask, sometimes they don't. But a lot of the facts are not right, just to be clear there.
So, Matt, what do you make of all that? I mean, first of all, I should say we were both in the press conference tonight. It's as we speak to you now, it is 10 to 11 at night. Roger Federer has just left the interview room, having said what he said. Those were the last two questions of the press conference. And, I mean, I've been going to Roger Federer press conferences for many, many years. That was one of the steelier stares that I've ever seen him fix on a media room. And it wasn't just on Mike Dixon from the Mail who asked that first question, a perfectly legitimate question based on the reports that we've heard. I thought he was clearly ready for that. I mean, he said himself he knew of the story. He decided he wanted to shut it down, but also just let us know that he didn't think we'd reported it correctly. The second one that Stuart Fraser of the Times followed up with, again, perfectly legitimate question. There's that pause. And when you were in the room, it seemed to go on forever. He was just looking at Stuart Fraser. And I was trying to work out, well, what's the pause all about? Is that just to let him know I'm not too impressed with that question? Or is it not quite sure what I'm going to answer? It seemed to me took him aback a little. What did you make of it? You haven't been to that many Federer press conferences over the years, but what was your sense?
No, it was delicious, wasn't it? That pause. It was there was this sort of wave just came over the room, and Federer had the room in the palm of his hand and was controlling it by, as you said, just not saying anything in that brief moment. And they'd already said that Mike Dixon's question was going to be the last one in English. And then Stuart Fraser popped up with this question that got right to the heart of the issue.
Which is what you have to do in that situation. I think too often, and I think this is one of the reasons for why it seems like a talking point, is too often we all just, or media rooms roll over because Roger Federer's in town. And there's always so much good to say about the guy. Let's not be honest. I mean, he's I think a lot of him. It's, as a person, he's an incredible player, one of the best we've ever seen. But I do think, look, the guy needs to be taken to task about certain things from time to time. This is one of them. And I thought, put two good questions, fascinating answers. Certainly, I do think the scheduling issues and the things that he let us in on there, that basically telling us it does go on. I don't always get my way, but it does go on. We know it goes on, but I do find it slightly alarming when it comes along at Grand Slam tournaments that are bigger than Roger Federer. However big he is, they're bigger than he is.
Yeah, we were talking off air, weren't we, about some of the sort of smaller tournaments, a tournament like Basel or Halle or something, where he's going to get the preferential treatment. And, you know, it's not an ideal situation, but you can very much understand it because there's so many other issues for the tournament directors going on. But it is at the Slams where it does feel the most uncomfortable. And we were talking as well about this sort of additional layer of sort of favoritism, if you will, if you say that. John Isner said yesterday that this was just about the top players, but it's not actually just about the top players. It's about Federer. There's the actual issue is Federer getting the preferential treatment over the other top players. Everyone knows that the top players are going to play on center and number one court at all the big events. That's just the way it is. The actual issue here is whether Federer is the one who plays on centre more than the other top players. And that's why, as you talked about earlier in the show, Novak Djokovic's comments were really interesting, because he wasn't overly happy with the situation at Wimbledon, and I believe he requested to play on centre, didn't he? His quarter final, which bumped Federer to court one.
Yeah, well, I think it was
after the Khachanov.
It was cumulative, wasn't it? To some degree, I think Djokovic sort of made his thoughts known two or three times, and eventually it happened. And I actually think fair play to Wimbledon that they did that.
Yeah,
they stood up and they said, you know what? Yeah. Time to put Federer on court number one. And lo and behold, he ended up losing. That's the way it goes. But something that we were talking about earlier, just about this feeling that Djokovic, well, he's got nothing to lose now, has he? He's flying suddenly, so he can afford to be completely magnanimous to some degree. But yeah, it's just interesting. It's an insight into what goes on. This is stuff that happens, and this is what's happened tonight in the conversation.
Mm.
So, tomorrow, what do we have? We've got in the afternoon session Novak Djokovic against Alexander Zverev.
Yes.
What do you think?
Tough to see anything other than a straight sets Djokovic win.
Really?
The head-to-heads won all, but Zverev's win came in Rome last year when Djokovic was not himself, and they played very recently in Shanghai, and Djokovic wiped him off the court. 6-2, 6-1, I think it was there. And he's just playing a level above anything that we've seen in this tournament, I think, so far. Federer was better tonight, but not on the same level that Djokovic was on last night.
I'm interested to see if Zverev can
interested to see how Zverev approaches the match, because he acts like someone who thinks he should be beating Djokovic, and he needs to start showing it. And What better stage? But there's it's such a tough ask. Djokovic was, I thought he was unbelievable against Isner. That he was just on it from the first ball. And when you play Isner, you kind of know that if you're not on it, you could get sucked into this match that you really don't want to be playing, because suddenly you can't break the guy's serve and you're in a third set. And he was so sharp, defended his own serve so well, and I was so impressed.
What do you think what do you think Zverev should do against Djokovic? Because his baseline game, and I don't mean his backcourt game, I mean his fundamental base is so similar to Djokovic's, but with a bigger serve. And I think if Djokovic is playing well, the movement is the difference.
Yeah.
As much as anything, he just makes the bigger guy move, and Zverev eventually gets found out. Does that mean that Zverev needs to almost do what Andy Murray started doing against Nadal and play outside of his comfort zone?
I think you have to play outside of your comfort zone. That's part of what makes Djokovic so good. He makes you change your game. He's so good at getting the pattern he wants in a match and implanting his game on a match. Zverev needs to hit big. And to be honest, he needs to hope, I think, that Djokovic is a bit off. Because if Djokovic is on, he's winning that match.
Yeah. And then in the evening session, it is Marin Cilic against John Isner. I have no idea who's winning that. I'd probably go Isner, just because Cilic seems a little fragile.
Yeah, I'll go with that. I did take a look at the head-to-head, which is quite heavily in Cilic's favour, I think, overall. But Isner's won more of their recent matches, interestingly. And yeah, Cilic is tough to back him at the moment, isn't it?
Jamie Murray's through with Bruno Suarez to the semi-finals. They've still got one round-robin match to play, but they beat Cabal and Farah earlier tonight. So they're through. Well done, Jamie Murray and Bruno. And yeah, that just about does it, I think, for another tennis podcast. Am I missing anything else? No?
No.
Well, can we go and get a beer or two then? Right. Bar it is. There's just a handful of people left in the media restaurant here at the O2 Arena. We will be back with another tennis podcast tomorrow. Thank you for your company. We have been produced in association with The Telegraph. We are executive produced by Melanie Bowes, tennisballs.com, SSS. Our mascot is Charlie the Ferret, and we're sponsored by La Manga Club, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.